This podcast is produced by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President, simplifying a complex money world with investment programs to match a range of investment goals and life situations. Now, today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our Tuesday, April 25th edition of Invest Talk, and we all want to build a retirement portfolio that will help us feel secure and confident about our future. So, does it take some special genius to do that? The answer is, not really. It just takes discipline and knowledge and understanding of what you're doing. And that D word of discipline doesn't have to translate to drudgery or self-denial or anything like that. It's really about the idea is to change your goal structures, right? And financial advisor J.J. Sessions wrote about this in Forbes. He suggests not setting a deadline for savings, but rather set a schedule, right? If you want to learn more about investing, rather than set a goal to read X number of books by the end of the year, set a schedule. Say, I'm going to read these 5 books this year, and it's going to take me this long, and I'm going to finish them in a lot of times. Probably you want to do that in various time frames as well, based on how big the books are, sophisticated, etc. Same with savings, right? You don't want to say, I'm going to save $50,000 in 3 years, right? You say, okay, I need to get to $50,000 in 3 years. Here's how much I need to save a month or a quarter, a week maybe. Put it down to a small bite-size timeline, and you're more likely to get there, because all you need to do is continue to hit that next little roadblock, and you do that consistently, and eventually it all adds up and you get to a bigger goal. Now, productive and successful people practice the things that are important to them on a consistent basis. The best weightlifters in the gym aren't the ones doing a ton of weight once a month, right? They're consistently there. They set the same time every week to go to the gym and work out. The best writers are sitting down at the keyboard every single day getting some work in. And then you translate that to professional sports or acting, whatever professional performance you want to think about. And it's really about continual practice, right? A dancer doesn't get great by practicing a routine once. They practice it over and over and over, and then suddenly they're pretty good at it, right? Steph Curry didn't get great at shooting 3-point shots because, he shot some threes every once in a while. He kind of did it when he felt like it. Right? He went on a consistent basis to the gym, shot X number of shots, spent X number of hours each day in the gym practicing a shot. And he had a plan as well. Right? How do I adjust my shot? How do I get space in the league, right? Meaning, how do I create my own shot? And he practiced those moves, and it became second nature to him. And that's what investing almost needs to be for you as well, is second nature. Saving needs to be second nature, not a chore, but so consistent that you don't even feel it. That it's like breathing to you, right? You don't think about breathing, you just breathe. So it's about continual practice and consistency. Now, one way to help meet your retirement goals is through educational aids, like our free live wealth webinars. And we have one scheduled this week. It's coming up tomorrow. So spend an hour with us. You can join up with myself and one of our other staff members, Jason Toper, for this hour devoted to helping the hands-on investor sharpen their analytical skills. Now, if there's a way you could be more efficient, spend less time, and accomplish more selecting stocks, wouldn't you do it? We'll show you some tools that the pros use and the amateurs like you can use as well for free to sift through thousands of possibilities instantly according to your criteria. And we're going to talk about some criteria that are very basic and then talk about some complex ones as well. So it's called Fundamental and Technical Analysis Back to Basics. It's 1 hour, coming up in a little over 24 hours at 6:30 to 7:30 Pacific time. That's tomorrow night, Wednesday, April 26. We'll show you how to figure out what metrics matter most, how to screen for attractive stocks, and also how to identify chart patterns that matter in today's market. And there'll be plenty of time for your questions as well. The presentation will last somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 to 50 minutes, and then we should have about 10 to 15 minutes of Q&A. We can talk about anything you want to discuss. So this is our 1 hour webinar. It is free, but you do need to sign up. Registration is limited, and we are filling up. I think we only have a couple dozen spots left. So registration is now open on investtalk.com. So why not sign up? It's free. Once again, it's tomorrow, April 26th at 6:30 p.m. Pacific time. So what many questions are on your mind right now? Our InvestTalk listener line is open at 888-99-CHART. But let's check in with our 24-hour listener line, our access line, for questions that came in between times.
Hi, my name is Ken from Wisconsin. I listen by podcast. Love your show. I just had a question. What's the difference, or how does it work when you hear someone shorting a stock position versus taking out a put option on a stock position? That's to know if that was the same thing, or if they're, what the difference is between those two. I look forward to your answer on a future podcast. Thanks. Bye.
All right, it's between shorting a stock and buying a put on a stock. Two different mechanisms, but you're trying to do kind of the same thing, right? Either betting on the market going down or hedging on a particular position or particular stock. Now, shorting a stock is when you sell, you borrow the shares from your broker, and you sell those shares in the open market, okay? Now, the idea is for the price of those shares to go down, and you eventually buy them back at a lower price, and you make the difference. For example, you sell the stock at $20 a share. You think it's going to go down for whatever reason. It goes down to $10 a share. You buy it back at $10, and suddenly you made the difference. You pretty much doubled your money, right? Because you bought it at $10, and you sold it at $20. You just did it in the opposite time than you typically would for a stock. Right, because you're borrowing it from your broker. So that's selling short. Now, you can also bet on the downside of that same stock by buying a put. Right? Now, on a put, you might say, let's say it's at $20 today. You think it's going to go down to $10. You might buy a put option with a strike price of $15. And you might pay, let's say, $1 a share for the right to sell that stock at $15, anytime between now and the expiration date, let's say a year from now. Okay, so you, it's at $20, sell that put option, strike at $15, costs you $1. And the stock goes to $10 between now and expiration. Now you buy it at $10, and you have the option to sell it at $15. So you sell it at $15, and you suddenly made $5 a share. But what did that cost you? It only cost you $1. So you actually made a 400% after you back out the dollar, 400% return on your money, right? You made $4 net on $1. So much bigger potential return for the same price movement. Now, if you sold the stock short, maybe only went to 18, you still made $2, right? But if you sold the put or bought the put and it only went to 18, well, guess what? Your now dollar that you spent on that put is worthless, worth nothing. So the bigger the move, the more money you tend to make on options versus, you know, shorting a stock in it on itself tends to be a little safer. So hope that's clarifies for everyone what the upside and the downside and the differences are of shorting a stock versus simply buying a put option on that particular stock. 8899CHART is our number, 8899-2-4278. Now, what are the pros and cons of owning dividend-paying ETFs? Should you invest in dividend-paying funds? Also, Trump put a tax on the Canadian lumber imports. We're going to talk about the impacts of that and where you'll see effects in the marketplace. And then what really do you need to be better off financially? What do you need to be better off financially? This is a great report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and they interviewed a ton of their members, ton of people, to see what defined financial well-being. And the people that were financially well-off, what characteristics did they have? Okay? So we're going to talk about that as well. And then possibly we have time pulling money from your Roth IRA. What are some rules around that and why Roth IRAs are nice savings vehicles? And in other ways, they, you know, you still need to play by the rules. So 8899CHART is our number. Give us a call. I want to hear from you. Let's take a quick look at the market today. We had the, or are we going to the market? Are we going to the break? Okay. So we're going to go look at the market today. We had the Dow up 232 points, the NASDAQ up 41, and the S&P up 14. This was a continuation of the trend that the European elections, the French elections, seemed to be going the way the market likes. So that was a positive as well. So there was some that were, I think, shorting the market in anticipation that Le Pen was going to win. And while she still has a chance on the runoff on the May 7th, the odds are against her. So there's that. And then there's also Trump talking about his tax plan, which I believe they're going to come out with the outline tomorrow. And there's reports that he's targeting a 15% tax rate, which the market likes. So whether that's true or not, I still think that's more of Trump hype and hullabaloo that really isn't going to come to fruition, but you know, the market likes it in the short term. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. What can we talk about today? What's really important to you? We talk stocks and bonds, but there are other important money topics that have an impact on your daily life as well. The line is open at 8899CHART. It's our live listener line every weekday from 4 to 5 Pacific time. 8899CHART, 8899-2-4278 is how you get through and ask your question. And I urge you to try to call in sooner rather than later. It's imperative. Oh, I guess we better go into a break. This is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. 8899CHART is how to reach me right now.
Good afternoon. This message is for Steve or Justin. I love your show. I'm calling. My name is Saeed from Illinois. So what do you think about Teva now? Is 52 weeks low. Should we keep buying it or should we hold? Or so I just need your opinion about that. Teva Pharmaceutical. Thank you.
It's another question about Teva. Or Teva, however you want to pronounce it. T-E-V-A is the symbol, and they're a generic drug maker. We have purchased this in our balanced income program, a little bit higher than it is here. Yields about 4.3% at these levels. And it's in a sector that, frankly, is down in the dumps. All the generic drug makers are under fire for for collusion and price fixing, etc. So the worry is that there's going to be extensive pressure to drug prices or generic drug prices to the downside for all of these firms, and it's going to hit their earnings dramatically. And there certainly will be a hit to earnings, so I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. That will likely happen. Now, the worry is that it's going to be such a big hit to earnings that it's going to maybe drive the company into distress, or companies into distress, since the whole industry is under fire. We continue to believe that the downside is still relatively limited, although, you know, it is in a downtrend near a 52-week low, and but it also is near big support. So to us, it has to hold the 30 level, and I think 30 is a huge, huge level opportunity. Now it traded at $30.76 at the close today. I was actually tempted to pick it up for one of our other programs today. So we still like Teva, but you have to understand, it is risky. You know, the industry is going through an upheaval, and while Teva is one of the better ones in the industry, we think the best one in the industry, it's not without its risk. There are risks involved, and they do have a decent amount of debt. So you have to understand, this isn't your typical drug company that is super safe by any means. The whole industry is going through upheaval, not just the generic drug industry, biotech, big pharma overall, in conjunction with the healthcare industry, is likely to have gyrations, and that therefore every company across the board is probably a little bit more risky than what you look at in the past. So we still like Teva, but understand it is still risky, and we're comfortable with that risk. Question is, are you? Let's go to James in Sonoma.
Justin, I wanted to talk to you about this KBWY.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything's so high, and I'm an old-time dividend investor,
mm-hmm.
so I'm just putting it in this basically because I already own Vanguard. You know, they're a REIT, not REIT, but they're ETF. You'd mentioned that. When you say dividend investing on ETFs, what's your opinion of this stock? Because basically it's a little risky as far as being a REIT in this particular environment.
Well, you're just investing in REITs, a REIT ETF, and it's pigeonholed into some type of REITs. It looks like this is KBW Premium Yield Equity REIT. Do you know what that means? What do they mean by premium yield?
I don't know. I'm assuming it's on the thing I look at. It says a little bit more risk. Obviously, it's more risky than say. The Vanguard, which you can see, Simon mm-hmm. Company and shopping centers and all that. These are sort of small cap, mid cap REITs.
Gotcha. And they probably yield a little higher than the average REIT, is my guess.
That's it.
Yeah. So, you know,
that's
yields
that's
close
it, but
to 7%.
You've got to invest money.
Say that again?
You have, everything's so high these days, you have a tough time looking for spots to. For a dividend investor, you have a tough time looking for spots to invest money.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But you don't necessarily need to go. The more you reach for yield, to me, this is a kind of a reach for yield. You know, you're getting about 7%. Anything in this market, it's getting 7%. You're likely taking above average risk, and you certainly are in this case as well. Because like you said, they're invested in kind of smaller REITs, and I'm looking at their list of REITs in the portfolio, and I don't recognize a ton of them. And actually, the one that I do recognize, we actually just sold for our clients because it ran up so dramatically and was so overvalued that we decided to sell it all. And that was Geo Group. And so, in general, this is something that you're taking a ton of risk with. And it's not just the risk of higher rates. You're taking on two sides: higher rates, but also the economic cycle. And if you look at, I've been looking at things like Jones Lang LaSalle and Marcus & Millichap, those commercial real estate public companies, and their charts just don't look very hot. And that kind of worries me about the whole commercial real estate space. And I've been hearing kind of behind the scenes from people that I work with on the commercial real estate side that there's a lot of cracks that I'm seeing. So I would not be invested in this. I think you're taking a lot of risk for, you know, decent yield, but there's much, much more downside, I think, than upside here. So I would either cut or eliminate this position. Thanks for the call, James. Now we're at the halfway mark of this Tuesday Invest Talk. Right now, let's hear your money question at 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast continues, but first a couple of words about our webinar. It's coming up Wednesday evening. Join registered investment advisors Justin Klein and Jason Toper Wednesday, April 26th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. That's Pacific time. Now, this webinar is free, but attendance is limited, so you need to sign up. Just go to investtalk.com. That's InvestTalk with two T's, investtalk.com, and click on the InvestTalk tab. Fundamental and technical analysis. Back to the basics. It's Wednesday evening, April 26, 6:30 to 7:30 Pacific time. And there'll be plenty of time for your questions, too.
Let's go to Glenn in Pleasanton. How you doing, Glenn?
Good. How are you doing, Justin?
Doing great. What can I do for you?
I have a question about Verizon. Okay. I've been in it for a long time. It's pulling back a bit right now. Is it a buying opportunity, or is there something I should be worried about?
Frankly, I'm a little worried about it, and I'm wondering what if this is an anomaly or because of the pricing pressures in the industry, is their operating profits are and cash flows are falling so dramatically? You know, I'm looking at operating cash flow in 2015 was about close to $40 billion, and their trailing 12 months is down to just under $23 billion. And you know their cash flow is still positive, and they can afford that dividend. But now their free cash flow has gone from $21 billion in 2013 down to only $5 billion in the trailing 12 months. So these figures kind of worry me, and I need to dig in deeper of why this is happening. Is it just simply the push for lower and lower cell phone bills, cell phone rates? That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Or did they sell off a big asset where they're losing cash flow? I haven't really dug into it deep enough. Have you?
Well, I've dug in a little bit, but I've been in AT&T and Verizon about 50-50 because I really like the sector and I see a lot of potential in it. But lately, Verizon has been diverging to the downside, and I'm just wondering what's going on.
Well, they've always been kind of the premium carrier now, right? And T-Mobile is starting to been gaining traction for a few years now and stealing customers from Verizon and AT&T, who for many years was kind of the duopoly within the industry with Sprint and T-Mobile trailing way, way behind. And it looks like T-Mobile has certainly passed Sprint in the on a business front, whether you like Sprint service or T-Mobile service better, it's up to you. But T-Mobile is certainly performing much, much better than Sprint now. And they're stealing a lot of customers and really pushing prices down on the industry overall, pulling them much lower. And now they have Unlimited for very cheap, and Verizon just came out with their Unlimited. So it's an industry where, frankly, I don't love it long term because of it's kind of a commodity. Do you really care who your carrier is as long as the service is pretty good and you get a good price? Not really. And so that's why I don't really love AT&T and Verizon because of that pull from T-Mobile and even Sprint to a degree. And they've been these premium duopoly services for a while, and they're almost getting now pulled down into quadopoly between the four. So I don't think Verizon is undervalued. I don't think it's a buying opportunity yet. I would say it's probably near value. So I honestly don't love it, and I don't love the sector now because of the trends that are going on. Now, the caveat is I do think it's short-term oversold, so I do think it will bounce in the near term. But I, to me, I'd use that balance as an opportunity to rebalance your portfolio to lower your exposure to Verizon and AT&T.
Very good. Thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate it.
No problem, Glenn. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Stefan in Palo Alto.
Hey, Justin. I appreciate you taking my call. Love the show.
Appreciate you making it.
Hey, question. The caller previous to this one, you guys had a discussion on commercial real estate. Personally, I think retail is dead, and it's just gonna die year after year. I just don't see retail ever coming back with the proliferation of online buying. I just don't see it personally. So I think there's going to be tremendous pressure on commercial real estate just from that angle. But I had a question for you on residential real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Since 08, after the crash, I recall talking to many realtors and brokers saying it's going to be years before we recover, years. There's so much inventory out there. And then suddenly, I mean, obviously with ZIRP and QE kind of fueling the fire, so to speak, it seemed like all of a sudden the problem went away. This inventory just was gone. And I know that were some big buyers like BlackRock and other hedge funds that went in and just bought enormous quantities of housing. But I never hear that really touched on. How big of a buy was that, and when are they possibly going to get out, and how is that going to affect residential real estate? Because I personally just don't see the value there. I mean, I'm living, you know, in a pretty hot market, obviously down here, but it seems like everywhere in the country, I feel a 2007 redux going on. And I mean, things are just stratospheric. Mm. And every realtor I talked to said, get in now. And everybody's, you know, it's FOMO, fear of missing out. I got to buy now.
I
go up anymore.
In general, I do agree with you. Yeah, in general, I do agree with you. You know, real estate broadly is at or near value and almost at or above value, sorry, in almost every market that we look at. And you're right, you know, Blackstone came in and bought a big portfolio of properties from banks. And that's there was a couple of reasons why inventory dried up. One was that where they came in and they did buy it off a lot of banks and helped banks out and recapitalize them and got those off the bank's books, because frankly, the banks don't want to own own real estate. And they realized that, and they were happy to get rid of a big chunk to Blackstone. And also they started to realize that it was better to just not foreclose. And I know many people here in California that just didn't pay their mortgage for 3-4 years before they were finally foreclosed on, saved hundreds of thousands of dollars in mortgage payments over that time, and just didn't pay their mortgage. And it was because the banks just stopped foreclosing, because they realized that not only are they going to get this property that they're going to want to sell, they're going to have to force to sell it at fire sale prices, but it's pushing down on the values of real estate broadly and the rest of their portfolio and the quality of the loans on their books. So it really was counterproductive for them to foreclose. So guess what they did? They just stopped foreclosing. At least at the rate that they were before. Now, is that picking up a little bit? Yes. Is Blackstone selling off some assets? Yeah, they actually announced last year that they're slowly, very slowly, I think it was 5 or 10% of their portfolio, going to start selling off assets. But they're smart. They're not going to dump it in fire sale either. They're going to slowly get out of things that maybe are underperforming or they see opportunistically to sell. So is real estate broadly overvalued? Absolutely. Do I see a 2008 type of scenario again? No. And the main reason is because lending standards have gotten better. But I think is going to happen is there will be a spillover in the next recession to real estate. It won't emanate from the real estate industry, right? The last recession emanated from the residential real estate industry. I don't see that happening again. Now, could it emanate from the commercial real estate industry, like you're talking about? Sure, I think that's possible. Is retail dead forever? I don't think so. I think you're over-exaggerating that to a degree, because I do think there's still things like high-end clothes. I think still for many, many decades to come, until technology advances so far that you literally, it's just you see it on you, right, on a hologram or something, then maybe you feel comfortable of not going into the store. But if you're spending hundreds of dollars on a suit, you probably want to go try it on, right? So I don't think retail is dead, but certain types of retail are dead. Certain types of retail will be pressured. Certain types of retail will not make sense at all in a recession, which we're not in now. So I think you're a little exaggerating on that front, but I do think it could be a place where it emanates. The next recession does emanate from. Does that make sense, Stefan?
Yeah, it does. And just one, can I interject with one quick thought on that? I'm just seeing a tremendous, and I think, I know you understand, but I think a lot of people don't understand the pace of technology. There are people out there that are creating the ability to measure your body so that you have the ability to shop online and be fit perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that based on what I've seen and the pressure, the tech pressure that's not going to stop, is pushing retail into the ground. It just doesn't make viable sense. And I think it's a good thing. It'll free up a lot of land.
Mm-hmm.
We you know, especially in the Bay Area.
Yep.
Well, there's a lot of commercial real estate that could be repurposed for mm-hmm. housing, which is badly needed.
Mm-hmm.
And with Uber and Lyft and other ride sharing, you can get some cars off the road. A third of most major cities is taken up by parking.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is going to be an enormous pressure from tech. Again, just my opinion from working down here, but I really appreciate your opinion and thoughts. I love you guys.
Oh, appreciate it, Stefan. And I agree that there is a lot of pressure from technology that is certainly going to pressure real estate prices, not only on the retail side, which you're talking about, but even just simple commercial office space, right? People are working from home more often. They're able to be more efficient and effective working from home or on the road. So they won't need as much office space or as many people to come into the office. So that will certainly pressure it, which you talked about. Parking, and if we can ever get to driverless cars and just a fleet of driverless Ubers running around taking us where we want to be, which I do think is the future. Now, I think it's farther in the future than probably most people in Silicon Valley think, because these things tend to the kinks tend to take a lot longer to work out. I do think there is long-term pressure on that front as well. So it is a lot to think about, a lot to consider, and I do think that the next recession will not emanate from the residential real estate market, but it certainly could on the commercial side, especially when you look at the level of indebtedness that large corporations have. If we get a recession, profit recession, they're going to need to downsize, and that will put pressure on their profits and their rents, etc. So I love the topic. I love your call. Glad you called. Thanks for calling, Stefan, and calling again.
Thank you, sir.
Now let's pivot to a very topical topic, and that is the report that came out today that we are now going to put a 24% tariff on Canadian lumber. And this is certainly going to impact new home buyers. And the question is, how much? Right. Well, Canadian lumber makes up about 30% of the U.S. lumber market. So very significant, not minor in any way, simply because, hey, there's a lot of trees in Canada, and it's our closest partner, right, logistically. And the tax on this lumber is expected to translate to a price hike on average of about 6%, according to the National Association of Home Builders. Now, there's other opinions that say 6% is it's a little extreme. Says for builders, an increase will cost increase the cost of construction by about $3,000 on average per home, which will likely be passed on to the consumer, which is true. But The difference is if you look at the numbers, the average cost of building a new home is only $225,000. So it's about 1 to 1.5% of the cost of the home, which is a pretty small portion. Now, the U.S. lumber producers are arguing that Canadian lumber companies get unfair support from the Canadian government because they tend to own most of the land in which the trees are harvested on, and they're just giving them that land. So, whereas apparently our U.S. lumber industry got to buy the land, etc. And so it's unfair is what they're arguing, and this is why the tax is being implemented. And I think there will be an impact on the home building market, and it might push up the price of real estate broadly in the short term. Now, is this going to have a long-term impact? Probably not. But be aware that this is something that will likely have an impact. And for me, I think of it more broadly because, say this works, say the impact on the industry is what the Trump administration wants, and it does help our domestic U.S. lumber industry, which in all likelihood it will, to be frank. I think he'll likely do this again to other industries. So that's why I look at this as bad news. I think it's bad news on that front, that it could be a test case for future tariffs on other industries. And if he starts slapping these protectionist policies, because that's frankly what this is, on more than just this industry, this is so minor in the grand scheme of the total economy that it's not going to have an impact. The market doesn't really care. Might care for home builder stocks and a few lumber stocks, etc., but the broader market doesn't care. But if this is a test case for what he's going to do going forward, I could, especially when it comes to NAFTA and maybe changing NAFTA, repealing NAFTA, getting rid of broad swaths of what NAFTA is, that to me is a much bigger worry. So look for that, monitor this, monitor what the next tariff he puts on and how soon that happens. If he does this quickly, this could pick up in pace, and then I would be really worried about the overall economic impact. Now you're listening to Invest Talk. You help us keep it real with your questions. What is on your mind? I love Stefan's question. Very broad, thought-provoking, etc. Loved it. So I want to hear from you. More questions like that. We can still fit your question in. We're going into the last segment, so give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Steve or Justin. Hey, this is Rob. I'm out here in Sacramento, and I travel into the Bay Area. I love your program. I thought I'd ask you about the REITs that looked like they got pretty hammered recently, and specifically some of the individual REITs that got really—they're really in the process of getting hammered, like currently. So I was hoping to check on like Simon Property Group (SPG) and Kimco (KIM) and maybe a few of the others, and see if it looks good for maybe taking a few positions in those, and or maybe just going to the alternative like the ETF and go a little bit safer route instead of the individual REITs. Just let me know if the earnings look good or what the forecast is with Amazon kind of coming into the picture and the brick and mortar maybe going out. Please comment on the REITs. Thanks. Love the program. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Well, this relates to our discussion earlier with Stefan, and he's looking at Simon Property Group and Kimco Realty. Simon Property is one of the largest retail REITs out there with a pretty big market cap. What is the market cap on Simon Property Group? Let me look that up real quick. That is $54 billion-ish market cap. Kimco is smaller, about $9 billion market cap. Both REITs, Simon Property Group yields about 4%, Kimco about 5%. And I think for a reason, Simon Property Group's certainly higher quality, but both are getting hit pretty dramatically because of the retail space. And like I said, it's an area that I do think is going out, and there's going to be a large lot of pain and adjustment. And so I would not be touching Simon Property Group or Kimco Realty. Not to say I wouldn't buy any REITs. We recently bought a couple, maybe 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, in a couple of our programs, and but they're involved more on the healthcare side. They're not tied to retail. So if you were going to look at the REIT sector, you definitely want to use an ETF or just pick a different sector, not retail. I know they look cheap, but like I said, this is an industry that is ripe for change. It's going through a transition period, and while it's weak right now with an economy that's kind of doing so-so, it's not going to look very pretty when the economy is in a recession, which, you know, which is likely going to happen in the next few years. We're due for a recession, right? And so I would not be chasing the yield here. In fact, the yields aren't nearly high enough for me to get excited. You know, 4 or 5%. I could find, we have half a dozen anti-cyclical names in our portfolios that are like packaged food companies yielding 4 or 5% and are much safer in my mind than Simon Property Group or Kimco Realty. So I wouldn't buy either of those. Now, what do you really need to be better off financially? It's a good one to end with. This is a report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and they ask consumers how they define financial well-being. And they told us it's not strictly about how much money you make, but also about security and freedom, and not just now, but in the future. So the first is these consumers who are comfortable feel they have control of their day-to-day and month-to-month finances. Right? They're not swimming in the hole every month. They feel comfortable with how they're living. They're living below their means. Okay. Number two, they feel that they're able to absorb a financial shock. So if they get in a car accident, they get laid off from their job, they have a safety net, savings, insurance, they have help to avoid severe financial turmoil. That's number two. Number three, consumers with a higher sense of financial well-being see themselves as on track to meeting their financial goals. And whether they have a formula for the plan or actively working towards those goals, they feel that they're on track. Okay, and this is something that Steve helps clients with, understand whether they're on track and make changes to get them on track. And that's what he's doing today up in the Bay Area. And if you ever want to talk with him, set up a call, that's something he can work out for you. And then finally, consumers feel they have financial freedom to make choices that allow them to enjoy their life. Meaning, whatever that means, whether it's hobby, traveling, whatever that is, it's that they're able to have the freedom to enjoy the little luxuries and not feel like they're in the rat race every single day. And that is what financial freedom is about. Looks like we're done with this hour. I'm financial advisor and licensed realtor Justin Klein, Chief Executive Officer of KP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. You can reach me directly with a question or comment. Just go to investtalk.com, click on the Contact Justin button, and I'll get back to you. On behalf of Steve Peasley and everyone at KP Financial, thank you for being with us. Let's plan on getting together tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.